Hello everyone, I'm Thomas Reward from 910 Comics.
And this is Ian Sampson of City of Reality and The Watch.
There have been a lot of problems recently with the hurricane over which hit the east coast of the United States, the tsunami which hit Hawaii, and many other natural disasters. And we're going to try and do something about that.
We're setting up a Red Cross charity drive, an idea started by a pseudonym, one of my personal favorite artists. The basic idea is that there'd be a live group tiny chat that we'd set up for the Red Cross charity event. Anyone who comes in and donates any amount of money directly to the Red Cross during this event gets a sketch done live for them. She's done a few sessions of this, getting more great artists willing to give their time and talents to the event, and it's been growing, especially now that we have the webcomic Beacon helping us out. This event has the chance to contribute to a good cause, get artists to network with others, and get us a chance to talk and hang directly with our audiences, and just have a great time together.
So make sure to tune in. We'll have more information over this at the webcastbeacon.com site. This will be hosted by myself and John Lotshaw of the Accidental Centaurs, as well as having many other artists coming in, some of your fan favorites and some that you may not know.
Thank you very much for your support.
And if you want more information, as I said, stop by webcastbeacon.com, or you can send an email to webcastbeacon@gmail.com for more information, or if you're interested in helping out.
You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast at newscast.webcomicbeacon.com.
It's Sunday, November 11th, 2012, and this is a Best of Webcomic Beacon Newscast with our guest today from City of Reality and The Watch, Ian Sampson.
Howdy, howdy.
From genderatic.com, that's GenderRatic.com, Typhon Blue.
Great job on the spelling.
You're going to do that every time, aren't you, Typhon?
If you get it right. Otherwise, I'm going to mock you mercilessly.
I'm used to that. You're a major mocker. From MTV Geek, Sean Kleefeld.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
From EvilSpaceCat.com, Marie Terry.
Meow.
And that leaves me. I'm your host, Thomas Revor from 910 Comics. That's 910CMX.com. And let's look at what we've had in the news. We're going to start off with one of our favorite punching boys. That's right. Lawyer Charles Carrion. Pulling up his Wikipedia page, and yes, folks, he actually does have a Wikipedia page. He's that notable, unlike apparently all of us webcomics. He was born in Phoenix, Arizona, attended Arizona State University, but later left after meeting and marrying his wife in 1974. He earned his Bachelor of Arts degree from Southern Oregon State College and his law degree from UCLA School of Law in 86. He was admitted to the State Bar of California in 87 and the Oregon State Bar in 93. He was admitted to the bar for the U.S. State U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, that's the Left Coast folks, in 1987, the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon in 1995, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in 2009. He's most notable for the famous Sex.com case, where entrepreneur Gary Creeman lost control of the domain to Stephen M. Cohen. The case took 6 years with a $65 million judgment awarded to Creeman in 2001. Carrion later brought a suit against Creeman himself over compensation for the case. And in 2008, Charles Carrion published, self-published, folks, a chronicle of his accounts in the Sex.com Chronicles. In 2005, Carrion was suspended by the Oregon State Bar for 60 days for the unlawful practice and failing to deposit or maintain client funds in trust. In September 2006, Carrion was also suspended for 2 years by the State Bar of California, stayed and placed on 2 years of probation with an actual 60-day suspension for violating his duty to maintain client funds in trust and for practicing without a license in Canada. Boy, he really gets around. Now, the reason we know of him here is because of the famous or infamous oatmeal versus funny junk legal dispute. What it that started off is that Funny Junk was appropriating materials from website The Oatmeal. Oatmeal sued back. Well, they didn't really sue. They started mocking Funny Junk doing other things. And that's when Charles Carrion stepped in. Because in June of this year, Carrion represented FunnyJunk.com in sending a demand letter alleging defamation and requesting damages from Matthew Inman of the Oatmeal. And on June 14th, Karen alleged he suffered security attacks instigated by Matt Inman. Oh boy. On June 15th, Karrion filed a pro se lawsuit, Karrion versus Inman et al. In United States District Court in California, against Indiegogo, the American Cancer Society, and the National Wildlife Foundation for alleged improprieties relating to an oatmeal charity fundraiser created in response to the Funny Junk demand. It goes on from there, folks. The most recent things that we've had is that he has also sued Kamala Harris, the State Attorney General of California, and many others, after just a lot of the legal wrangling shenanigans that have been going on. Karrion also requested a temporary restraining order to stop the financial disbursement of the donations, and this is after he had sued, saying that this wasn't a real charity fundraiser, and they weren't going to be distributing monies anyway. Mashable also named Karrion's first case amongst the list of silliest tech lawsuits ever. And he's also trying to find and sue the owner of a satirical site, charles-karrion.com, as opposed to his own site of charles-karrion.com, leading Public Citizen to seek a federal declaratory judgment to protect the satirical site's owner. Karrion is now trying to subpoena Karrion for some of these lawsuits. Only he is dodging the subpoenas, mailing them back unopened, refusing to answer his door if it looks like it's somebody who's going to be serving him, and just a lot of legal tricks. Now, Sean, you're on the heartbeat of the webcomics and comics world over at MTV Geek. What have you heard about the Karrion travesties?
It's just, you know, honestly, most of it flies beneath my radar because it's so absurdly silly. All of it, every bit of it. I mean, it's just, he is beneath my notice, honestly, for most of this. So I just let all of this go by. Most of what you read just now was new to me because it just, I just, when he started suing the oatmeal and that whole thing started blowing up, I was just like, you know what? This guy is an ass and he's trying to make money, trying to make a name for himself, whatever way he can, and try and use whatever legal maneuverings he knows how to get out of any retribution from any of it. And it's just, it's absurd. It's just every bit of it is absurd.
It seems like his whole career has been of the absurd. I mean, we've called him the, Jack Thompson webcomic world. Jack Thompson being the lawyer who sued over violence in video games and was eventually disbarred. Some of the tricks that he's pulled.
Yeah, it's just, it's all technical legal crap that he's pulling, and it's just, I mean, it's like, I'm trying to think of a good counterexample. It'd be like, suing somebody because they have a patent on how to use a swing set or something, you know. It's absurd. Every lawyer in his right mind, every judge in his right mind who's looking at this has just got to be shaking their head in shame.
Exactly. And some of the things that he's done, like I mentioned, he started off, one of the things he sued the oatmeal over was the fundraiser that they had for the American Cancer Society, based off these whole shenanigans. He sued them, saying that they weren't really going to be dispersing the money out. It was basically, most of it was going to be kept by the oatmeal. And then when he realized that it appeared that they were actually going to be doing that, he sued them to prevent them from dispersing the money. When we call him our favorite punching boy, I mean, he's really, you got to hand it to him for some of the stuff that he's doing. He is proving that not all lawyers are actually that smart.
Wait a minute. I just had a thought. You know what? It's really a big joke. This guy, he's going to keep doing this for the rest of the year. And then, like, on January 1, he's going to step out at a press conference, pull off his mask, and it's going to be Andy Kaufman. This whole thing is just a big joke. That's what it is. It's a big play act for him.
I wish I could agree with you on that one. It is a big joke. I don't know if it's going to be Andy Kaufman. That really wouldn't surprise me. But it really is. To me, it's a sad state of litigious society that we live in here in the States, because it is – you can sue almost over everything. I mean, this makes the McDonald's hot coffee lawsuit seem like groundbreaking stuff.
Yeah. Well, his issue is, the biggest issue I have with it is that he keeps going on. You know, if he wanted to sue over, you know, the oatmeal thing in the first place, okay, it's stupid, but I can understand where a lawyer would try and do that. But that he keeps coming up with his inane stuff over and over and over again and keeps dragging it out over increasingly banal garbage is just insane. It's just...
I disagree with you. Insanity definitely seems to be one of the things, especially some of the stuff he's suing over, such as the site Charles-Carrion, which is obviously a satirical site. I mean, it's no more than the fake Steve Jobs or some of these other sites that we have, where people are poking fun at someone who is got some level of notoriety.
Right.
One of the other stories that we covered was about writer and artist for the newspaper comic Pearls Before Swine, Steve Pass, is talking about the future of newspapers and comic strips, as well as a little bit of the online stuff. Sean, you wanted to talk about the story. Why don't we go ahead and hand it over to you so we can get a little bit of the background on that.
Sure. Well, you know, Pastis was just interviewed for, you know, just a kind of here, you know, let's talk about your latest Pearl Before Swine book, yada, yada, yada. And in the midst of this, they start talking about webcomics. And what he says is there are a lot of good webcomics out there. And he actually cites several of them by name and says these are really well done. But then he goes on to say that they're claiming to make a living. But how do you know? Because, you know, that's online and nobody's feeding dollars through the screen or anything. So are they just lying or what? And then goes on to say that, you know, newspapers are fine and he's making a handsome living because he's in like 700 papers and that's all good. And for some reason, this story just really struck me the wrong way. For a couple of different reasons. One is he just that oblivious about webcomics? I mean, it's clearly, yeah, nobody's feeding money through the screen or anything, but why would you doubt that, you know, people have been making money on this for years now? I mean, the Folios have been doing it for, what, almost 10 years they've been self-sufficient? Yes. Yep. I know Jenny Breeden. I never pronounced her name right.
Yeah, Pete Abrams, many others.
You know, yeah, there's tons of guys, the Penny Arcade guys. I mean, Christ, how much money do they pull in, right?
I've actually got the quote from him from the IndieWeek.com article. Let me go ahead and repeat it off for people here. To quote, "Now, to make it, you have to go through that web route. Many of those guys, from Penny Arcade to Cyanide and Happiness to the Perry Bible Fellowship, which are all excellent, claim to make a living, but how do you know? I can tell you that even if someone does a strip and it's fairly popular online, money is not online. I question a lot of claims about the money being made, and that question remains that if things continue to go that route for newspapers and you have to make money online, how do you do it?" Now, I do know that there are a lot of the old-timers who are in syndicated strips for newspapers really don't know. They are that oblivious about webcomics and the online community. John Lawshaw from Accidental Centaurs and the Bill Holbrook Store, who is a member of the National Cartoonist Society, actually was at the recent convention giving a panel on the future of online status and how to make the transition from print to online, such as Bill Holbrook and many others have done. And it was very well received. The current president of the NCS, and we've had him online here, and I cannot remember his name, I'm sorry, but he is also very pro-webcomic. A lot of the webcomic people who are in there were due to his efforts. So yeah. There is a way which the old timers and a lot of the syndication, such as King Features and many others, don't know about this whole new frontier, even though we've been around for a long while. And when they discover it, it's fascinating, it's wonderful, but, you know, it's oblivious.
Yeah, well, you know what strikes me is there have been a couple of attempts, notable attempts, of newspaper strip artists that on their own just decided, let me try this webcomic thing. Rena Piccolo, who does the, I can't remember the name of her strip offline. The online one she tried was Velia Deer, totally different than her newspaper strip. And there was the other girl who does the dinette set, and I'm drawing a blank on her name. They both tried going like their own personal route, and I don't think either one of them was successful because they were so used to this, you know, newspaper syndicate model that they didn't know how to make that transition.
Exactly. We're seeing something similar, not in the failure success rate, but in the transition over from Mark Waid and Thrillbent, which we've talked about here in the cast as well. Sure. And a lot of the stuff that he's discovering, even though he is very pro webcomic and very pro online publishing, a lot of what he's discovering is stuff that some of the old timers in webcomics have learned along the years.
Yeah, and to Mark Waid's credit, this is what I think is the main difference, is what Waid had did when he launched Thrillbent. He went out and said, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And he was soliciting input from, you know, the Scott Kurtzes of the world and saying, what do I do to make this work? And how do I make this work? And the thing about the Pastis story that throws me is that he's like actively not looking this stuff up. He's actively just ignoring that it's out there even and saying, well, you know what, they're just kind of throwing garbage to the wind there.
Exactly. And even for people – oh, go ahead, Jason.
The question is, where is he looking at this stuff? I mean, where does he – is it conversations with colleagues? I mean, is it something that he's completely missing? Is he just not online?
Right. And let me draw you into this, Ian, because, I mean, City of Reality is a relative newcomer to the webcomic industry. I mean, there are a lot of questions I'm sure you, as a new, well, a relatively new webcomic, or you've worked with The Watch for a while now, that you have had in doing your old webcomic. Where were some of the things that you determined about this?
One of the things I determined is I'm terrible at business. And I'm pretty sure a lot of webcomic artists, especially those who, you know, are a lot more used to the creative side of things, don't look that much into the business side of things and what they should do to make it work. And unfortunately, I'm kind of one of them at the moment. But that doesn't mean, just because I'm ignorant, doesn't mean that it doesn't work, that others haven't proven that it works. And it's just... it's possibly he's just kind of the same way. He just doesn't see how, because it's so different from the way he's used to it.
I think that's kind of what sticks in my craw about this, though, is that you're at least acknowledging that, yeah, it does work, and maybe you don't have everything worked out yet, but you know that there's somebody out there who has figured it out, and you just need to figure out how it works for you, which is cool. You know, I mean, it's obviously some work that you have to work on and whatever, but that's cool. And Pastis is not, it doesn't even acknowledge that there's a working model. And that's the part that really throws me, especially since Pearls Before Swine started as a webcomic, essentially.
Well, it started as a webcomic under a subsidiary of a newspaper, right?
Yeah, but, I mean, that's how it was presented, is, you know, unlike the traditional newspaper model where, you know, you would take it to the newspaper, the newspaper editor or that syndicate editor says, yeah, this is good. And they start sending out, you know, versions to all the newspapers. They put Pearls Before Swine on their website for, I think it was like a year before they actually went ahead and tried to syndicate it. So he was effectively just a webcomic, not getting paid. And he knew he wasn't getting paid at the time, which is fine. But that's how he got his start.
Right, and that may actually have colored some of the things he has, because he may have figured that everybody who does a webcomic is not getting paid for it. And in a lot of them, they're not. If they are, it really is pittance as compared to what a regular job is. Sure. But, I mean, part of that is we've always talked about how webcomics are more of – a lot of them are the trial, the basis, the starting point for getting something out there, and the money isn't in the webcomics itself. It's in a lot of the merchandising. I mean, exactly. Penny Arcade is making almost nothing off the comic itself, as a story we're going to talk about in just a little bit has shown. But they do make it off of merchandising and the tie-ins and everything else that they have. Same thing for so many others.
Yeah, yeah. And if I can throw in a little plug here, that's a lot of my MTV column kind of centers around that. A lot of my columns, I find I keep going back to that and saying, you know, look, there people aren't making money by putting their comics online. Of course, you're not going to make money by putting your comic online for free. You make money on the T-shirts and the mouse pads and the book sales of the collected editions and whatever else you've got going on. Whatever
exactly.
works for you as your particular comic, as your particular personality work through, that's where you make the money, is not on the comic itself.
And you had mentioned Scott Kurtz earlier. One of the battles that I had with him a while back was the fact that, to me, webcomics, back during the start of Zuda, the DC attempt at having a webcomic conglomeration, was that, to me, webcomics are a way for artists and writers who would normally never be seen by the New York people or the Los Angeles people, the people in the business, for them to get their work out there, for them to get noticed. And as we've seen, I mean, the vast majority of webcomics fail because a lot of it, people go in and expect to be a Penny Arcade or a huge success right off the bat, and it doesn't work that way. But it is a way for people to show that they've got the work ethic, that they've got the talent, that they've got anything which will translate over to the professional range. And we've become a whole new industry ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's one of the things that's proof of that. Even if I got a couple of stories on this, actually. First one is that they're not only are these people making money out there, they're telling you how they're doing it very blatantly. I was talking with Ryan Estrada a little while back. And he doesn't have like a regular series. He does, you know, a little off one-offs and two-offs kind of thing. And that seems to work for him, which is cool. And he got married recently. And his, at the time, fiance eventually asked him, she said, she was kind of a shy girl, I guess, and eventually kind of said, well, you know, I know you do comics and they're online, but how do you make money? And do you make money? Are we going to be able to make a living as a husband and wife? And he, you know what his answer was? He said, Google it. And so sure enough, she typed in Google, like Ryan Estrada finances or whatever. And my MTV column came up. First thing, first link. And it was Ryan Estrada's finances for the past 5 years. Because I had talked with him and got his approval to post all that stuff online. And it's a very detailed, here's what I made in year one. Here's what I made in year two. And he talks about what works and what didn't work and why he only made X amount of dollars this year and that much more the year after and all that. Dorothy Gamble of Cat and Girl does the same thing. You go onto her website, she has a month-by-month chart. Mm-hmm. Here's how much I make every month. Here's how much I go out every month. And here's where it comes from. This is how much from book sales. This is how much from T-shirt sales. You know, this information is out there. It's not hard to get at all.
And that's one thing about the webcomic community that I've really enjoyed is that the vast majority of the people are not shy about telling you what works, what doesn't, giving you suggestions. I mean, whether it be the pay for information books such as the How to Make Webcomics from webcomics.com to other groups that and other people that will sit down with you and talk with you. At conventions, you can sit down with creators and they're more than glad to tell you some of the stuff that they've tried and what's worked and what's not. It's completely different from any other business model and business people that I've seen.
Well, this is something that I've been talking about lately, is because it's still that emerging market. Still that emerging market. You know, there's not, we haven't gotten to a point yet where, like you said, most people who are doing webcomics aren't making money, or at least not enough to live off of.
Most people doing webcomics, you know, if there's some people doing webcomics that's a misnomer saying most people doing webcomics aren't making money. Let's say most people doing webcomics that attempt to do it as a living aren't making any money, because that's more accurate of a percentage,
right.
because let's be honest, because this is a statistic that no one likes to hear, but 99% of all webcomics fail in the first 6 months.
Right.
And it's a shame. I mean, we can go on that, because any business, if you start a small business, any business is going to be in the red for the first 2 to 3 years. That's just a well-known fact. And yes. Webcomics are the same way. You've got to stick it out. And, at conventions, I mean, we're asked, what is the one thing that we can do to have our webcomic be a success? And I half tongue-in-cheek will say, start it 10 years ago.
Exactly. Because it's because
you have to show that longevity. You have to show that you're going to be around and draw an audience.
It's also part of the whole the first people in line got the most traffic early on. Because lots of the beginners, I won't say all of them, but lots of the beginners who stuck around the longest like Tom said, the longevity, showed most of the get up and go were the ones that people kept on going back to regardless of current quality. And I think we all know a couple of the people I'm talking about here, right?
No. But on this point, since we're talking about a business, let's go ahead and go on to the next subject of stories that we've talked about in past Comic Beacon newscasts. And that was the emergence of a new business model where people would actually give you money up front before you started doing anything, based off of plans that you've had or ideas that you've had, called Kickstarter.
Yes, now, speaking of which, I'm starting a Kickstarter where I want to create my own island nation. It's going to be a libertarian nation. We're going to have a standing Air Force. We need $6 billion.
I got okay. $20. What's my reward for that?
Yeah,
you get to be depending on how much you donate, you get to be one of my citizens.
Tax free?
Yeah, actually, because one of the things that was said here is one of the big things about how Kickstarter works. To me, it strikes me of the PBS pledge drives. If you pledge a certain amount of money, you'll get this. If you pledge more money, you'll get this, and it keeps building. Depending upon what goal is reached. And then if the minimum goal that they need is reached, then they are contract bound to actually produce whatever it is they're going to be doing. If they don't, none of the money is taken out of the account and the thing just goes away. We've had a lot of success stories of people who are going through and, you know, they're asking, you know, well, we want to make $20,000 to cover our production costs. If you donate this, you'll get this product. If you donate this, you'll get that product. And end up making $100,000, $200,000, $1 million, $2 million.
And what Kickstarter is what they call it is crowdsourcing, where basically you leave it up to the people to give you money for what's basically vaporware. And lots of different people, Kickstarter is a good idea, because without it, Tim Schafer wouldn't be currently working on his new game. You know, same with Chris Roberts and his new game, and Lori and Corey Cole. Lots of gamers I grew up working, playing their games. They're making new games again without the support of EA or LucasArts.
And not just gamers, but we're also seeing, I mean, over in the entertainment industry, one of the stories that caught my eye was Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Worf from Star Trek The Next Generation, is wanting to do a webisode series with some of his former castmates, and they've got Kickstarter going on. But one of the most recent stories that we've had was on the other end of it, and that was Penny Arcade wanting $1 million for their comic, and they tried to do it through with a lot of waypoints that were, I'm hoping, were tongue-in-cheek. And I don't want to go into some of them because they were rather risque. But
ridiculous is the word.
So, Tom, what did you get confirmation at Gabe and Tycho yelling at ducks?
Well, no, because they did not make their $1 million. Their Kickstarter failed.
Unless they made their minimum goal. It wasn't the minimum. No, their minimum goal wasn't $1 million. They made their goal. It was like
their minimum goal was like $250,000 or something. And then stretch goals up to $1 million.
Right, but the ducks thing I would really like to know, because that would take a couple of days. Yeah, their minimum goal was $250,000.
Well, I'm seeing over on flesheatingzipper.com. Boy, there's a URL. The minimum goal was $250,000 to have the leaderboard on the homepage removed.
From there, it was $325,000 for an original six-page automata strip to all the way up to $525,000 that all the ads on the homepage removed. And
just kept going and going. But they did make their goal. And I don't know, do you guys want to comment on why you think that they didn't make $1 million? Or is it really a lost cause at this point?
I want to see them yelling at some damn ducks.
Yeah, me too.
Well, in the article that they have from Flesh Eating Zip, they've got the whole article is why Penny Arcade's Kickstarter didn't work. And some of the things they've got in there is, you know, horse first, then cart, which basically the way that they were going against what the Kickstarter rules were going. You know, they're for projects, not for companies, to things like the rewards were lame, which we've talked about a little bit here. And Penny Arcade was presumptuous on getting some of this stuff, like having Mike run around scream your name at a duck, or Tyke will name your pet.
I have to take argument with that because that's Penny Arcade shtick. I mean,
Tyke thinking about you all having sex with his wife.
Yeah, I mean that's their shtick. I mean, so what I think the fact is that they were already doing well, and there wasn't like you said, Tom, there wasn't really a project going for it, and their final goal was to get ads off their site, which, if you look at their site, it's well designed. You don't really even see the ads, so
here's what I want to throw out there is the problem I have with the article is I don't know that it's the arcade thing was a failure, because I mean even if you're looking aside from the fact that yes, they made their basic goal or whatever, it wasn't a failure because Kickstarter is still fairly new. And people are still figuring out how the hell it works, right? So I think even though it didn't hit all the goals that they wanted it to hit, I think it ends up being a very useful tool for everybody to look at it and say, okay, they didn't make $1 million or $1.5 million or whatever their ultimate goal was, but they made $500,000 by doing this, that, and the other. They didn't make $1.5 million because they also did this, this, that, and the other, too.
To me, one of the things that kind of insulted me about it is, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of the Kickstarters that are legitimate. I mean, they've got their business plan. They've got their projects. They've got their waypoints set that are right in line with what they're doing. And this seemed more farcical. Plus, I mean, these are people who were so against taking donations. And that's basically what they're doing. They're requesting donations. But they're by using a crowdsourcing name, it's not really what they're doing, but it's what they're doing.
Well, donations by any other name. But, it comes also down to, I mean, maybe it was a success, but is this really the place for an established business? So it kind of goes back to, you know, it's for smaller projects, for people who are getting started. And it also, I think that this kind of gave birth to the term, what was it, getting tired of Kickstarter. I mean, how many projects do you back a year as just somebody sitting in front of your computer? And do you back the people that you think are really going to start up and do something interesting, or are you going to back somebody who's already successful?
Well, let's say that the biggest issue with the crowdsourcing model is you could be nobody and you could say, I have this idea for something great, and someone could go for it, or you'd be like Penny Arcade and say this is not a donation drive, but we need donations to drive something. Tom is right. It's like the PBS model where you donate $20 and get a Bee Gees CD.
I want a Bee Gees CD.
But basically Kickstarter, as we said, it's relatively new, and a lot of the copycats that they've got are even newer. So we're going to go ahead and continue on with Kickstarter stories for a while longer, see how this goes on. But we've got one more story that we want to talk about before we take our first break and go on to some more lighthearted fare after that. And that is very recently, Project Wonderful has added on, or actually added back on, adult ads. That's right, not safe for work ads. The main reason they pulled it was because Project Wonderful does all of their financial transactions through PayPal. And PayPal is very stringent on the way that adult
entertainment is handled. They do not allow a lot of it, and if they find out about a site going through that, they will lock out that account.
Just ask now, Eric.
Yeah.
A point of soreness of from him, if anything, it's he can talk about that in depth whenever you meet him.
Yeah, and I mean, we've had a little bit of experience with that ourselves with others literally having their accounts locked out, not getting any of the money for it, and the people mm-hmm. who don't give the money don't see it for a while back before it's returned. Right. But Project Wonderful has been going through, and let's go ahead and dot the thing here. Apparently what happened is that PayPal went after a site called Smashwords right. for adult erotica, and PayPal was accused of, quote, burning books, which I still wonder about in the e-publishing business.
What they were doing is – Smashwords isn't just an erotica site. It's a self-publishing firm for e-books. And once you're blocking any kind of content, and it does fall under the word book – you're going to get in a lot of trouble. And even though they weren't physically burning books, they're still arbitrarily preventing content from getting to people who paid for it.
See, if they had censorship, that would be one thing. Burning books, you know, and that's a specific thing. And the connotations that go along with it, I mean, didn't quite go. But it wasn't – I mean, this is something that PayPal has been doing for a while now, and it wasn't until a very popular site, was hit by this that people actually really gave a flip over.
Yeah,
but it does mean that Project Wonderful, as you said, which handles all the transactions through PayPal, has the rules have been loosened up, and PayPal has Project Wonderful is allowing this new category in for the ad. So, I mean, if you do want that type of ad on your site, or if you wish to have that type of ad, you can now. Right. And is this a good thing, Ian? I know City of Reality, not really. Is I won't say an adult site, as in Bow Chicka Wow Wow adult, but it does have some concepts that go on beyond the kiddie fair. I mean, do you think that this type of advertising is going to allowing it back is going to be a benefit or a negative?
It's a benefit because webcomics of all types, webcomics can be anything on any subject, including not safe for work type of content. And they shouldn't be limited like that. And if they can't get advertisement revenue, then that's not good for any of the freedom of speech or the freedom of creating any kind of story that you want to make.
Murray, let me go ahead and bounce the same question over to you. I mean, is it a good thing for these types of ads to be back? Do you think it's a good thing for PayPal to be loosening up? And why, depending on which direction you take?
Well, I definitely think that having being able to then stuff that's, you know, not just kiddie fair, not just absolutely G is, you know, definitely good again. I mean, there's artwork that is like, you know, not necessarily adult like XXX, but like erotica or whatever. And, you know, even in my comics there, I have been worried at times that PayPal would shut me down just because I have a little sort of side boob or something going on. You know, not necessarily full frontal nudity, but there's, you know, they're wearing a provocative outfit or they're, you know, it's not a kid's comic. There's a lot of violence, but I'm more concerned about the nudity. There was like one scene where this character appears totally nude and I'm sitting there paranoid that I'm going to get shut down by PayPal. So the fact that they're kind of loosening up on it and that it's, you know, sites that have that sort of content can now show those kind of ads without necessarily having to, you know, partner with either a larger, wait until they're big enough to partner with a larger ad network or, you know, and it's so, Project Wonderful is so good for comics. Like, it's just so good for comics to advertise on because so many comics use it that you're actually, you know, if you are an adult comic starting out, you can use it now and actually reach an audience that, you know, you want to reach, especially if you use the ratings correctly. That's probably the only thing that really, you know, kind of gets my knickers in a knot every now and again. Pardon the rather erotic pun, but the I know it's terrible.
PayPal is gonna screw us over. Thanks.
is when the companies don't use the ratings properly, and you do end up with adult ads on like a G site or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that because it really does come down to the way that some of these companies use the ratings. I know I have to go through and approve every ad that goes on to 910 Comics because there have been some adult sites that purposefully or by accident mark their stuff as suitable for all ages. And I'm wondering which country that this is suitable for. If they use it properly, yeah, it would be a lot easier on us. But, you know, things like that happen.
But we do have that capacity as site publishers to basically approve everything that goes up. I mean, we can do that. And it's a pain, but we can do it.
And you don't have to go through some of the hoops that you'd have to go through with Google Ads and some of the other sites. And there is no minimum. I mean, you can actually put up, advertise my site on $0 and still get some hits on there. I think Project Wonderful has been very beneficial to the internet in general and webcomics specifically.
I definitely think so.
And Atlantically.
Point, we've got a story back from NBC News about one of the Playboy Playmates joining us here in the webcomic world. That's right. Pamela Horton, who started off as a game when she was 5 years old, and who wants to be her dream job is to be a character artist in the video game industry, has joined us in developing webcomic. She was Miss October back in 2012, and has gone on from there. Now, Ben, you're a resident Playboy expert.
And I never bought a single issue, actually. But I do have opinions on this. So, number one, she actually is extremely good. And she isn't just a pretty face that is moderately passable as an artist. No, she's actually a very skilled artist. It's actually... So don't make assumptions on her based on the fact that she has an amazing figure. No, she actually can draw amazing figures as well.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the art in the article, and there is some drawing. I mean, a lot of what she's doing is kind of comic-y. I mean, her webcomic is Kitty Climbing Trees, it is a very cartoony, but a lot of this work that she's done here is also very good, very detailed, beautiful artwork. And do you think that, Sean, let me go ahead and toss it over to you, because do you think that by having, I don't want to use the term celebrity, but somebody that is definitely more noticeable than the stereotypical comic book or webcomic creator is going to be a benefit for this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, at least a benefit to her. And her comic, absolutely, yeah. That's not uncommon at all for, you know, a celebrity of any sort of film star, TV star, famous author, whatever, to kind of switch venues and just use their name recognition to get some attention. Drawing a blank, there was the guy who was in the Transformers movie, the latest Indiana Jones movie. What's his name?
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf, yeah. He was going around this year, right? Trying to plug his little movie.
The world's worst webcomic, yes.
Well, it wasn't even a webcomic. It was something he made through, not iBooks, but he made it through, you know, on his Mac. Made by Mac was on the back of each of the comic books that he made.
Apple loved that so much.
Sure. And there was he was at one of the shows where
he was at C2E2. He just showed up. He called, and it was mobbed, apparently.
Yeah, he was just insane. He was as a matter of fact, I read a story. He was sitting, sat down next to Keith Knight, and Keith Knight said he'd never seen so many people at his table before in his life. And they were all for Shia's little whatever comic that he did. And he even admitted, Shia admitted, that it was crap. He said, everybody in the artist alley is doing better than I am artistically. But he said he just liked doing it and was using his celebrity to plug that. Now, like you said, Horton here, she's actually, from what I'm seeing, it looks to be very talented, you know, so why not take advantage of her name recognition and bring some of her fans who look at her naked to buy her webcomic, you know?
That's a good point. There's no bad thing. There's no such thing as bad publicity unless you have Shia LaBeouf sitting next to you. The next Tom Hanks, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I guess that this article can also be summed up and that it answers the eternal question, who here's a Horton?
well, it's. I'm just waiting for Shia to try that at another convention because I'm waiting for him to get beat up again in public and someone scream at him, "Where's Bumblebee now?" again.
But let's go ahead and, I mean, let's go to another topic that was at the, well, say at the edge of our periphery. And that was our famous Nyan Cat Pop-Tarts Rainbow Sequin Pasties. That's right. A company is hand-making the famous Nyan Cat little Pop-Tart cat that has the annoying music with the rainbow trail behind him, making pasties of him for burlesque shows.
The market for... Yeah.
And let's go, I mean, while we make our contacts, contacts, comments, and other jibes at this, let's go ahead and go to somebody who was right on top of this story. Murray?
I knew it. Yeah, on top of it. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I remember this. I remember this because the people making it were actually here in Vancouver.
Yes.
Over here in BC. We're all about... tassels.
So like, how many sets did tassels. You buy?
What? No, me? None. Nobody's seeing me with these on. Forget that. Oh no. Not that there are people who probably would like to, but no, forget it. But I can see some of the nerdlesque shows that go on around here having these and having the neck at. Well, somebody. And never mind. I'm just not even going to go there.
That's what they're there for. I mean, well, I don't think they're recreational use.
We talk about
show
the vast conglomeration is the right word. The infinite number of possibilities which we see on the internet for anything and for something like this. I mean, the Nyan Cat thing becoming such a famous or infamous thing in such a short time, and then for it to spin off into pasties.
Oh, nice pun there.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I like that.
But I mean, we actually got some of the behind the scenes stuff when we actually got talking about this, and somebody made a joke about Star Wars pasties, and before we knew it, somebody had looked up a person that is making Darth Vader burlesque pasties.
Yep.
You gotta wonder about. I mean, even considering some of the topics that we've covered or that we create in our web comics, some of these are strange even for us, folks.
Here's let me put this out there. If you're wearing a pair of these and your audience knows that you're wearing a pair of these, you're doing something wrong.
It all depends upon the type of show that you're doing.
I don't That's care true. What type of show you're doing. You're doing it wrong if that's what they're looking at.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
But, Yes. We could go on talking about this forever, but we want to go ahead and this will segue over into our next one, and that is that the New Yorker censored a cartoon for showing where pasties go. That's right. They actually had a cartoon where they had the artist redraw one of their cartoons to put Adam and Eve in clothes, simply because it had a couple of dots where anatomy is usually. Now, I mean,
but didn't newspapers for years run Love Is?
Some of them still do it, I think.
Yeah. But the kind of chibi-ish characters they use for Love Is don't have a pair sticking out like that, much less something to draw notice to it. Now the Facebooks, over on thenewyorker.com where they talk about Nipplegate, yeah, that's their own name for it, folks.
Good for them.
Is that the card comic? Some of them got temporarily banned from Facebook for violating the community standards on nudity and sex by posting the Mick Stevens cartoon with Adam and Eve sitting there, and to be honest, post-coital, saying sitting there and there all together.
Really?
Really.
Wow. They obviously haven't been paying attention to what's on their service, because damn.
Yeah. And in fact, to correct myself, it says that hoping to get back into Facebook's good graces, Mick redrew the cartoon for us, but the gain in clothes caused too great a loss in humor. I take a look at them. Yeah, it completely loses the joke about it.
Which is actually kind of interesting in and of itself, is that he's using the redraw as a commentary on the the whole situation, basically.
Yeah.
You know? Because that's stupid. I mean,
it really is.
Yeah.
It's like flipping out over cartoon nipples. What?
But not even cartoon nipples. I mean, because we can say, I mean, there are people who spend hours detailing the each and every bump around a nipple. Right, Ian?
And where can we find this?
Yeah. This was nothing more than a couple of, you know, quickly drawn dots, to, which could allude to it.
Circle, circle, dot, dot.
It didn't even have the circles. It was... Some of the things, I mean, Facebook, just like a lot of the other sites, can be a bit hypocritical on what goes up.
Well, considering, like, there are, like, explicit furry porn fan pages on Facebook that I have seen, like, what? Like, a couple of dots? You're making a fuss over a couple of dots? Like, really?
It's worse than that.
You got all these other teens with their tops off on their party, wild parties, showing off their boobs to this, what?
I got a story for you about that, but that it doesn't quite fit with this topic, but after the show, I'll tell you the story.
If you're interested in these types of groups, folks, find them on your own. We will not be including these within the show notes.
No.
You have Google.
I'm just saying they exist, and people are freaking out over dots. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, it really does go through, and it makes a lot of the online community, and as I said, groups like Facebook, especially with their stock problems, look really bad. But let's go on to we've got one more topic within this category, and that was from a story over at our friends at robot6.comicbookresources.com, and that is Edgy Comics Bingo. That's right. A lot of people who get into both print and webcomics who, to be edgy, keep running across certain tropes. And in this article... it has a comic from Kathy Leamy, L-E-A-M-Y, with the Edgy Comics Bingo, where it has a lot of these tropes down to play bingo on. It really just is – they've got it scored as to exactly what a lot of these on-the-edge comics are.
Yeah, it's. I'm looking at this, and this almost looks like this actually reminds me of something else that I keep posted near my workstation – the 22 panels that work, but for these are the panels that work for the wrong reason.
This is the updated version of the old, 1950s and 60s tropes of if you put a gorilla on the cover, it will sell more.
Jimmy Olsen swaps bodies with a gorilla again.
Well, and I'm looking at this whole thing. Every one of these 25 squares, and that's including the free space in the center, looks like one Frank Miller comic.
it's the 90s, just basically put into just focused and put into a grid.
Yeah, actually, I've seen almost every one of these on the infamous Disney parade drawing that Wally Wood did.
That's scary.
And do you know what I'm talking about, Jason?
I think I do. This is on the.
You may be thinking of the famous reason that Harlan Ellison was the shortest working person at Disney, but which is another.
I completely missed that reference.
It's let me talk about this, this was done on the
wall there, right? Was it in the cafeteria right now?
Yeah, we'll talk more about that after the podcast, because at this point, we're going to go ahead and take our second break, and we'll be back with our last story, one which we've been building up to right after this.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network. Follow us on Twitter for news links as we find them at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeaconnews@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We are also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books,
news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back to the wrap-up for the Webcomic Beacon's Newcast Special Edition. We've talked a lot about a lot of the good things that go on in the webcomic world, ways to improve your comic, ways to get yourself noticed, and how to not give up and continue on with the work. Well, this can be considered a good story, but it's also kind of disheartening for those of us who have spent a lifetime in this type of industry for someone else who has literally spent his lifetime in it, and that is Malachi Nicole and his brother Ethan. Malachi Nicole is best known as the creator and writer of Axe Cop. And he started this off with his brother. His brother is 28. Malachi, when he did this, was 5. No, not decades. No, not dog years. He was 5 years old when they started Axe Cop. And now it has become a sensation, including it is going to be one of the new shows on Fox's Animation Domination Saturday Night Block, going along with the classic Simpsons, the not classic Family Guy, and other Seth MacFarlane travesties. I'm going to let somebody else take this, because I mean, I shake my head at some of the stuff that goes on with this. It really is a bit disheartening for people who spend their life, spend decades honing their craft to see something like this happen.
You know what? I've tried reading Axe Cop. I don't get it.
Well, I'm just surprised that like Cartoon Network didn't pick this up for like Adult Swim. That seems more their style.
God, how bad could it be if Adult Swim doesn't want it? Or maybe it's too good for Adult Swim.
Well, Adult Swim usually doesn't want a lot of the good things anymore. It's like, oh, this is making us money. We have to cancel it.
we talk about the Adult Swim stuff, and Axe Cop goes along with the type of stuff that this is. Sean, working for MTV, I'm sure that there are a few things over there that you've may have commented on about with this. Let's go ahead and hear your thoughts on it.
I'm just always amazed, always, always amazed at some of the stuff that gains popularity. You know, my entire life has been one of kind of not being in quite with everybody else on everything. And that's why, like, if you go through MTV stuff, there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. There's lots of hip and happening stuff. And then there's me off on the side doing the webcomic thing. And I feel like that with Axe Cop too. Just like Ben said, I don't quite get it. I'm pissed that I wasn't 5 years old and thinking up something that is this popular. I'm pissed that I'm 40 years old and still not thinking of something this popular.
Well, the way I see it is this is some of this weird kind of reasoning that people have where if it's totally random and stupid, it has to be good. And I think that's really the reasoning that goes behind why this kind of stuff gets power. Because, oh, it's totally random and stupid. That means it's genius. I'm like, no, it doesn't. It just means it's terrible, and you're terrible for looking at it.
Yeah, it really does seem like it's that the demographic they're going for, that seems to be a lot of what the Fox animation, Saturday night animation, not some of their other stuff, seems to be the 18 to 24-year-old stone college kid type thing.
They're hipsters. They're all hipsters.
That's oh, hipsters, damn. Get off my lawn. This is kind of coming back to a conversation, not that I had offline a long time ago. But they're really, just for webcomics themselves, there are two kinds that do well. There are some that are meme-based that really just carve out a niche with looking for a way to become viral and really taking over with the Nyan Cat stuff and just, you know, taking that stuff wholeheartedly and pushing it out there without any kind of, I won't say that they don't have any artistic integrity, but it's almost there. And then you have people who are really hard working on building narrative and story, people like Pete Abrams. And I think that you can make a success either way. It's just how much of your soul you want to give out.
Well, Murray, I mean, we haven't heard from you on this particular topic. I mean, have you seen anything about Axe Cop?
I watched part of the first clip. I've never, like, I've heard of it, but I never really, like, I looked at it a little bit and I went, this is a name, and was just walked away. But when I, you know, like, I spent a long time thinking about things like popularity, and like looking at something like this, and I think it's, I have some friends that are a lot younger than me, like a decade younger than me, like, and or a little bit more than that. And something I do notice about these friends of mine is that they have a very different sense of humor and sense of communication than I do or people my age do. And I'm younger than you guys. So I'm not saying like, I'm not in my 20s. I'll say that. Like, I'm older than I'm out of my 20s, and I'm into, you know, that age. But my friends are just coming out of high school. Some of these friends of mine, and they really have a different sense of humor. They really have a different, like this kind of stuff really does appeal to this inane, weird crap. Like, just kind of like, I find it crap. But, and there's actually a lot of stuff on, like, the like, I have different set of, I guess, a different programming, because I'm in Canada, so my programming doesn't quite line up with yours. But you know, I see what's coming off on our, you know, Toon networks and stuff like that, and I'm just like, what is this? Like, it makes friggin' Teen Aqua Hunger Force look sophisticated.
Aqua
what
Teen
the hell?
Hunger Force.
Yeah, that actually thing brings up a good point, because I mean, the one thing that I got from this was, I don't get it, but I mean, it was from a different generation than I was. I didn't get a lot of the stuff that was on Ren and Stimpy either. Is this just simply the next generation of inanity?
Well, I want to point out, as someone who like was among the first people to kind of discover it when it was first hitting the web, when we first heard of Axe Cop, and you know, you hear this thing, a webcomic drawn by a professional, written by a 5-year-old, that's one of those ideas that click immediately and they say, hey, that is pretty dang awesome. And I read it, and it was hilarious. It was crazy. It was obviously written by a 5-year-old, and I don't know. I love reading what children write and what they come up with, and there is inanity. There is craziness. There's stuff that doesn't make sense, and I love that stuff.
Well, to me, if I may interject, may I?
Well, one more thing, because okay. I'm going to go the other route here. But the problem is, it's not something that's completely sustainable, I don't think.
Right.
Like, there was this fan fiction by Squirrel King called Half-Life, Full-Life Consequences, and it was just as crazy and stupid and pointless and filled with bad grammar that, you know, they didn't try to be funny, but every single line in that thing is hilarious. When it got popular and videos were made of it and people made parodies of it, Squirrel King actually made, like, a sequel, and no one cares about the sequel. So that's possibly I watched a little bit of the clip of Axe Cop, and it doesn't appeal to me. So
and something that struck me was, I mean, because it wasn't that long ago that the movie Aragon, based off of a book from a 9-year-old, came out. I mean, are we seeing preteens be the new genius source for material, or are
he
is
was
Hollywood
13,
just really that bankrupt?
He was 13, by the way, Tom.
Okay, so he just became a teenager.
Christopher Paolini, and the reason the book was published was because his parents owned a publishing company.
Ah, so that explains it. That sounds a lot like certain stories on Keenspot, but
yes,
I'll listen about that.
Yes, yes, we don't want to bring him here, Crosby, Crosby, Crosby. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of this is... As you said, I mean, it seems to have been written by a 5-year-old, and for it to go to an animated series, I mean, to take this, I used the word before, inanity, and have it go through professional hands to become, what, professional inane?
Well, this reminds me of one episode of Dexter's Lab that was really experimental, where they actually had a script sent in by a 5-year-old and read out by the same 5-year-old, and the animators purposely drew it like it was drawn like a 5-year-old. I think you all know this episode of Dexter's Lab I'm talking about.
Yes, actually, I do remember what you're talking about. But, I mean, that was its own self-parody. Can we consider Axe Cop a parody of something else? Is it a self-parody? Or was this an attempt to be intentional?
Is it kind of a parody of comics in general? Like,
I don't think it's that cerebral.
The creative process? I don't know. Well, you could argue it.
Well, the thing is, there's
something. It's a 5-year-old, and it's something probably somebody just thought would be hilarious. It's like, oh, I'm just going to have a 5-year-old write it, but it'll have really awesome art, so everybody will look at it, but it's written by a 5-year-old. Oh, this is hilarious. We're like trolling the internet.
Well, it sounds like it sounds like a Geoff Johns comic now.
Well, I go back to the Frank Miller stuff, so.
Hey, he had a solid Daredevil run, man.
Yeah, and his Wolverine miniseries with Claremont was terrific, but, you know, I think maybe he had a mini-stroke or something and just kind of went off the deep end, yeah. But let's go ahead and get some closing thoughts on this as we begin to wind down. Let's go ahead and start off with Marie. You got anything else that you want to bring into the mix for our retrospective show?
It's been fun to be on it, the show in general. Since I'm still pretty new, all told.
Okay, then let's jump over to Ian. Let's go ahead and see what you got for us.
I've only been here like 3 times.
Well, actually, let's go ahead and why don't you go ahead and give out Sue's for our charity thing if you're interested in pre-contributing or if you wish to help out in a lot of the artwork. What's that email once again?
Oh, absolutely. That is sued@gmail.com, PSUEDE@gmail.com.
Okay. Ben, I mean, you've got your own podcast over at Animation Aficionado, so we don't want to hear anything that you say anymore.
Well, that's true, but we are still looking for guests. Anyone who's interested in talking with us about any cartoon or disagree with us on any of our past topics, we will gladly revisit any topic with anyone that comes on. Yes, that includes the fact that Neil and I hate Naruto. If you love Naruto, you're welcome on the show, and we will be nice.
And, of course, let's go ahead and jump over to Sean. Sean Kleefeld, our geek good over at MTV Geek, who covers the comic world for them.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. Always a pleasure to be a guest here. And if you're looking for more fun stuff by me or not, you can go check out Kleefeld on Webcomics over at MTV Geek. You do Kleefeld on Comics for my blog, or if you pick up the Jack Kirby Collector magazine, I've got a column in there as well. So plenty of me to go around if you want more.
And if you're one of those who are starting off a webcomic or you want to pick up tips, there's a lot of the stuff that Sean has in his column are good for both beginners and people who have been in business for a while. And that leaves up with our news editor, Jason Strasberg. Jason, your cohort in crime, who unfortunately could not be with us today, Eric Kimball.
He's on vacation.
Yes. and out of communication. He's away from the interwebs. But you're the one responsible for a lot of the stories that we have in here, including the stories that we had in here. I mean, which leads to the question, was it you or Eric who found the Nyan Cat pasties article?
It was all me. He actually asked me not to do it. He personally begged me, but I twist his arm.
Really, Eric? Eric doesn't seem like a prude to me.
He's covering. He's covering. He's
a prude. Well, he's covering. That's why he needed the pasties.
Yeah, he's covering the tips.
and as may I say that if you have any tips and you would like to submit them to us here at the newscast, please feel free to check out the website and either comment or send us an email. Ba-dum-bum.
Absolutely. And that leaves me. I'm your host and ringmaster for this circus. I'm Thomas Revoir from 910 Comics. It's 910cmx.com. This has been one of our more interesting shows, going back and looking at some of the things on here. And I'm looking forward to the next coming year and actually just the next month and a half. We're going to be taking a little bit of a break next week because it's the Thanksgiving weekend. And we'll be back with some more news between then and Christmas. And more information, we'll all see you in the funny papers.